We have a lot of scientists out there today, a lot of people with letters beside their name, PhDs, MDs, and so on. And look at how sick we are. We're spending billions of dollars on, for example, our health care, and it doesn't seem to be helping us whatsoever. And somehow or another, people with credentials are the people who are supposed to be turning to help us with our health. And these people with credentials don't seem to be helping us at all. Otherwise, we wouldn't be as sick as we are today.
Your Honor, I would like a continuance.
This case has already been delayed several times, Mr. Reed.
I realize that, Your Honor, but I would really, really, really like a continuance.
I'll have to hear good cause, Counsel. What's the problem?
I can't lie!
Commendable, Mr. Reed, but I'm still waiting to hear good cause. Now, do you have one or not?
Not!
The movie was Liar, Liar. This hour is going to remind you of that movie because we are hearing a lot of lies from where we least expect it. Scientists. Let me read you a quote. A common misconception is that science and research are about facts. Say what? This is from an editor of the British Food Journal, 2006. Just think about what he's saying. A common misconception is that science and research are about facts. Oh boy, is this going to be a lively hour. Pam Colleen is in studio, so here we go. This is your captain speaking. Fasten your seatbelts. There is turbulence ahead. Happy New Year, Pam.
Happy New Year, Andy.
Here we go again.
Oh yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around this quote. A common misconception is that science and research are about facts. I'm terribly naive. I thought it was about facts.
No. Today, it's more than that. It's really more about marketing purposes than anything. And this actual quote, and it's a direct quote, was in response to a retraction that had been requested of the journal. The journal had published a very flawed study, and a group of scientists internationally band together to try and get the study retracted. And this was his response. He was trying to defend the study. And honestly, this study had terrible flaws throughout it.
So, what is science now, today, in the year 2012?
Well, as Dr. John Ioannidis has said, and we've talked about this before on the show, he says, I think, up to 80 or 90% of the science that's published today, in the medical field in particular, is flawed. So it's not necessarily accurate science. You see, companies, what they're doing is they're buying their own science. They're customizing it for their own commercial purposes. And when these studies are published in what looks to be credible scientific journals, unfortunately, you know, the science itself isn't very credible. It's just got one goal in mind, and that is to sell product.
Folks, the way this works, as you know if you listen to the show regularly, is Pam brings guests to this show from all over the world. And she sends me endless research and videos of her various guests and the research. And every time I just shake my head and I go, I hope this stuff isn't true. It's very entertaining, but I sure hope it's not true. You have another fascinating guest on this very subject this morning. Pam, would you do the introduction?
Absolutely. It's a pleasure today to have with us from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Francesca Griffo, and she is the senior scientist and the director of the Scientific Integrity Program. Good morning, Francesca.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Francesca, you are all about integrity.
Well, I try.
Well, you work very hard. I've been watching a lot of your YouTube presentations and so on, and you've even testified before Congress on the subject of scientific integrity. I mean, you're really passionate about what you do.
And let me just jump right in, Francesca, because some folks are saying, well, another American guest who doesn't know anything about Canada. I understand that the folks up here in Canada have been watching you so closely and have been so fascinated with your passion for integrity when it comes to science, that they've had you come up and visit.
Yes, absolutely. I had the privilege of coming up and speaking to a group last year, and I'll be back in Vancouver in February. The American Association for the Advancement of Science are having their annual meeting up in Vancouver, and we're doing a panel specifically on Canadian topics because, as I understand, you know, this is beginning to be more and more of a problem. I feel like in some ways, you know, you are all starting to emulate in some ways what we had with our last administration with your current politics. So it's tough times all around for science and scientists.
Well, I'm fascinated by what you just said, and I want to ask you to expound on that. But first of all, I'm just confounded, really, by even the very organization that you belong to, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and you're concerned about integrity in science. I thought science, by its very definition, was about facts. And here we read this quote, "A common misconception is that science and research are about facts." What does that mean, Francesca?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I don't want to paint every scientist with the same brush. In my experience, most scientists are working very hard. They're trying to do the right thing. The work that we do is pointing out where there has been political interference in science, which was rampant in the last administration. And unfortunately, we have a few examples, even with President Obama, where we're trying to turn things around. But I think what we really started doing this year is looking behind the political interference. And in fact, that's where we're finding a great deal of corporate interference, inappropriate corporate interference in science.
Now, how is it that companies are doing this and getting away with it so far?
Well, I mean, I think they're doing it in a number of different ways. They're corrupting the science. They're shaping public perceptions. They're restricting agency effectiveness. They're influencing Congress. And they're even exploiting, you know, judicial pathways, going after the judicial branch. So it's a big problem. I mean, I don't want us to think that it's every single scientist. I don't want to paint them all the same way, because I think what I found in our federal government, and we've done, you know, huge surveys of scientists across the federal agencies, is, you know, they're as frustrated as we are in many cases and are really trying to do the right thing.
Before we get too far into it, let me just ask you this. How does this affect mom and dad and the kids at the dinner table?
Well, it affects them in a whole variety of different ways. You know, pharmaceuticals, food safety, clean air, clean water, you know, what's on their plate, what's in their air, what they're drinking. All of these products are subject to our regulatory system. And, you know, I know right now it's really kind of fun to bash regulations, but in fact, you know, these regulations are what keep those products safe, so that when we do sit down to eat, we have some confidence that, in fact, we're not going to end up ill all night, or even more significantly, you know, having longer-term health effects. So, in fact, those regulations matter, and that's what costs industry money, and that's where we see that inappropriate influence, is trying to eliminate those regulations.
And now, can we talk about maybe that as it pertains to food safety and where some interferences may have occurred along the lines?
Sure. No, you know, in food safety, we've seen a lot of different examples. I know that recently, you know, you've had some local examples, which I'm not totally familiar with the details on. But in the U.S., for example, you know, we recently had a problem with cantaloupes. That's the most recent example that we've got. And, you know, in fact, when you look at it closely, many of these examples, what you're seeing is that we don't have the numbers of inspectors. We don't have the folks out there really working to look at those foods and make sure that they're safe. And what happens is, you know, we end up with unsafe things slipping through and making people ill.
Right now, what is your greatest concern about a food product that's out there that would fall under this umbrella of being contaminated, and we just don't know it?
Really, at this point, it's imported foods. It's foods that are, in fact, you know, a great deal of our foods, and I think Canada as well, are manufactured and packed and, you know, made in other countries. And we just don't have, at least in the U.S., the inspectors in those other countries looking at those foods and making sure they're safe before they get to the U.S., or inspecting them at our borders.
Now, let me guess, what country might be at the top of that list? Would that be the same country that makes virtually everything that we buy?
It just might be. I don't have numbers for exactly, but certainly we have big problems with things that are being imported from China, which I know is what you're talking about.
I wouldn't...
You know, melamine in milk, melamine in you know, different pet foods. I mean, those were all huge issues.
And malachite green, and, of course, fish and seafood and so on. That's been an issue here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't lick a stamp from China. I mean,
well,
after
I
the whole...
It behooves us to be careful. I think it behooves us to know about our food, to buy local, you know, to eat as locally as we can. I'm very proud to be in a CSA, a consumer supported agriculture. So I know where my produce comes from, and I'm a crazy label reader, And I think we all have to take that responsibility.
Francesca, we look at that story from China, which I can't think of a greater horror story about food being contaminated, this malamine in children's milk. First of all, are you entirely convinced that that whole story was true?
I only know what I've read. So, okay. No, I don't have direct experience.
Okay,
with,
but, I mean, but every indication...
What I know is true is that we don't have enough folks at the border making sure that what it says on the label is what's in fact in the package.
What I'm saying is people here reacted with absolute horror and disgust about that story from China, and we're really quite arrogant about it because in this country and in this continent, we have governments that are ethical and moral, and they have all kinds of scientists who protect us from... this kind of ethical obscenity. What you're saying is, hang on, maybe not.
Well, you know, let me give you another example. We've had problems, in fact, with E. coli in cookie dough. One example in 2009 sickened 72 people in 30 states, putting 34 in the hospital. And we know that for at least 3 years before that outbreak, the plant, which was here in Virginia, you know, where the dough was manufactured, had repeatedly refused to cooperate with food safety inspectors. You know, example after example after example like that. Raspberries, peppers, peanut butter crackers, chicken pot pies, poultry. You know, I could go on and on. Ground beef is another one. I am very careful about where I buy my ground beef. And even stuff that's found its way into school lunches. So the U.S. certainly, you know, has significant and serious problems.
So the companies really aren't policing themselves very well, and they really don't want a lot of regulation, like things like the country of origin labeling and so on. There's just been resistance all around to have enough regulation over a lot of these issues.
Yeah, peanut butter, eggs, you know, we can go on and on. It's I think as consumers, we have to be careful about what we buy. We have to be careful about refrigeration. You know, we have to do our part. But I think it is a fair expectation that we should have a regulatory framework that does protect us.
Francesca, we have to take a short break. If you just hold that thought, when we come back, I want to ask you about fear. Okay. The fear, the rampant fear from watching your videos this morning that scientists are the people who can blow the whistle, the people who know what's happening but can't tell the truth. Because the consequences to them are too dire. Fear, when we come back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
The color of the pen that I hold in my hand is royal blue. One lie and I can't say it.
You saw the movie, Jim Carrey in the movie, Liar, Liar. His little boy wished that daddy for one day couldn't tell a lie. And then it happened. We should wish the same for the people who run our corporations. We're dealing with a situation in London right now, Electromotive. And we really wonder what their agenda is. Wouldn't it be nice if they would just hold a news conference and talk to us about it? Wouldn't that be a concept? And just tell the truth? Pam Colleen is in studio this morning. We're talking about... scientists who so much influence the quality of the products that we buy, everything from food to our skin lotions to just about every product we use. Are they telling us the truth? The fact is they can't. We're in conversation with a scientist who believes in integrity in science, Francesca Griffel. Francesca, let me ask you this question. You did a survey asking these scientists in a key position to tell us the truth about these products, and you found something rampant, and that was fear.
It's true. There is a great deal of fear of retaliation. You know, we have nearly 5,000 scientists working across 10 federal agencies who responded to our questionnaires in recent years. More than 1,900 federal scientists said they feared retaliation for discussing their agency's mission-driven work.
And you've also interviewed them on the manipulation of science as well, from what I can recall, that they've been pressured to manipulate science as well.
Well, this was far more common in the last administration. I will say things are looking up, things are better. We've done a more recent survey of the Food and Drug Administration that we'll be releasing, and a lot of these numbers are a lot lower.
Good.
But give not us, the whistleblower number.
Give us one example.
The whistleblower numbers are still significant and too high.
Too high? You mean that there aren't enough whistleblowers?
No, they're too afraid of retaliation. Too many of them are afraid of retaliation.
Mm-hmm. In other words, there's a lot of people out there who could tell us some real horror stories about the products we buy, but they've been gagged.
Exactly. And in fact, not only have they been gagged, but a few of their comrades who have been courageous and spoken out have seen their careers absolutely damaged and destroyed. I mean, it's very difficult. It's a hard, hard decision for someone to make. But on the other hand, whistleblowers are the last line of defense. They are the folks who are on the line, can see what's going on in ways that those of us on the outside simply cannot have that sort of access. So they're very important. We are working, I don't know what kind of legislation, you know, there is in Canada, but we have something called the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which we are trying to get through Congress, because over the years, there have been so many court challenges to this act, of course, because it's a very powerful
yes.
and scary thing to have these folks speaking out. And we are working hard now to close some of those loopholes in the law so that there are more protections for whistleblowers.
Francesca, we have to take a short break for a news update. Give us something to chew on during the news break about a product that you would be afraid to use because you're suspicious about what we don't know about what's in it or how it was made.
Here's what I'm worried about. Physicians taking payments from pharmaceutical companies. I think what I'm worried about is everybody should ask their physician, do you get speaking fees from a drug company? That's an important question.
Okay, we need to talk about that because there's a new law coming up in the United States that's going to help hope to circumvent a lot of that.
Exactly.
Okay, and Francesca, can you tell us, these are all American problems here in Canada. We're lily white. White as the driven snow, which has been flying around all around us, and we don't need to worry about any of this. That's what I thought. Very eloquent. We'll be back with Francesca Griffo in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJB.
Your Honor, I would like a continuance.
This case has already been delayed several times, Mr. Reed.
I realize that, Your Honor, but I would really, really, really like a continuance.
I'll have to hear good cause, Counsel. What's the problem?
I can't lie!
Commendable, Mr. Reed, but I'm still waiting to hear good cause. Now, do you have one or not?
Not!
I wish that for only one day Dad couldn't tell a lie.
I wish that for only one day Dad couldn't tell a lie. If you saw the movie Liar, Liar, you remember that delightful scene. Delightful movie, actually. People have asked me, why are newscasts 5 minutes long? And I've said, well, that's because of surveys which show that a man can't go longer than 8 minutes in a day without telling a lie. There actually was a survey, and I'm telling the truth. There was a survey which showed a man cannot go, I don't know whether it applies to women or not, but a man can't go longer than 8 minutes in a day without telling a lie. I mean, we're being lighthearted about this, but this is a very serious subject. In studio this morning, as we always are on Thursday between 10 and 11 with Pam Colleen. Pam, it's absolutely almost beyond belief to me that we, one of the first things my parents taught me was honesty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they said for two reasons. First of all, because it's morally, it's the right thing to do. But secondly, lies blow up in your face.
Mm-hmm.
So to think that we have on a rampant, widespread scale lies being told to us in our modern, sophisticated age mm-hmm. by industry is mm-hmm. almost unthinkable.
Well, I mean, this has been learned behavior, adapted behavior for many, many decades now. I mean, it goes way back to Edward Bernays, for example, the father of propaganda, who came up with the notion of creating marketing-based science and hiring, you know, spokespeople like doctors and celebrities and so on to be their basic representatives of their products. And this type of pattern is still existing today, except it's been amplified, you know, many, many times over.
We're in conversation with a friend that Pam Colleen has brought along, thanks to the joy of telephones. Francesca is talking to us from where is she?
She's
from
in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. Francesca, I want to pick up where we left off just before the break, and that is this whole issue of whistleblowers, people who are in positions where they could tell us all kinds of horror stories about the products we buy, but they've been gagged. Can you give us some examples of the places where they would be found? Is it in the bowels of the companies that make many of the products we buy? Is it in the universities, like the University of Western Ontario and Research Park, like the Robarts Research Institute? Where are they?
Everywhere. All of the above. I mean, we find, you know, we have examples of folks that speak to us from the federal government, from universities, from private, you know, the private sector, all of the above.
I've heard scientists even at one of our local universities, University of Guelph, I've heard scientists complaining that they can spend years doing research on, say, something to do with biotechnology, and if the research results don't come out the way the company likes them, the research gets brushed under a carpet.
Absolutely. There is definitely selective publishing. You know, we call that publication bias, and there have been a number of studies looking at this, but, you know, over and over again, we find that the trials that support the approval of the drug get published, and the trials that are negative get suppressed and are not published. And certainly that's a scary thing.
Francesca, we know right now that there are people who are listening to this program are saying, that woman needs to see a shrink, because this is paranoid schizophrenia at its very best, in capital letters. And yet, you belong to an organization called the Union of Concerned Scientists. Is this a movement that's growing, and what is it on the verge of doing that you have hinted at?
Well, we are a group of, you know, there's about 150 of us that work at the Union of Concerned Scientists, but we have members and activists and scientists, you know, about 250,000 that are a part of our networks and really care very deeply. Now, I don't think we're all paranoid. I think, you know, you could get paranoid reading this stuff over and over again. But on the other hand, we've also seen great change. You know, we've seen things turn around and get better in many instances. So I think we try to point out the good where we find it, but we also feel that it's very important for people to understand, you know, where the problems are. Because if we don't know where those problems are, if we don't point them out, we can't begin to address them.
Because, Francesca, I still work on the naive belief that most people basically are good. Most people basically are honest. Most people basically don't enjoy lying. And you'd really have to have a gun to your head to be part of a system that on a regular basis pumps out lies, mistruths. So what are you saying? How do you account for the fact that we're getting all these lies and that people are aware of the truth but can't tell the truth?
Well, I think you're right. I think most people are good. Most people do the right thing. Most people do their jobs. But unfortunately, we also have something called golden handcuffs, where there are tremendous amounts of money running around and flying around, whether it's to influence, you know, Congress and lobbying, whether it's contributions to elections and, you know, influencing who gets elected in that way. You know, the money flows. And that, unfortunately, has a very corrupting influence.
Now, this has influenced the quality of education in our schools and our universities. I mean, a lot of the researchers, a lot of the professors, even up at the universities, are basically focusing more on trying to get grant money than they are on quality of education. What do you say to that?
I think it is. It's tremendously difficult. I think that we have many people in power who just don't understand the importance of basic research, who don't understand that while a topic may seem silly at the face of it when you read it, that in fact there's, you know, we don't know which basic research is going to lead us to the next really good place. So we have to fund a lot of it. We have to do a lot of it. And I think there are very broad misconceptions about the importance.
But what has happened to science while all of this, you know, search for grant money is going on? What has happened to the quality of science, not just in our universities, but in our, you know, high schools, elementary schools, and so on?
It's challenging. You know, I'm a mom. I have two teenagers. It's challenging. I think that across the U.S., we are not doing as good a job as we might at teaching science, all the way from the elementary level, particularly, I think, at the elementary and middle school level. I mean, let's not forget, we are all born little scientists. You know, what's the first thing you do as a two-year-old? You say no. You question. You want to know. You want to see the evidence. You ask why. You know, those are all very scientific behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, our education system in many instances doesn't nurture it, doesn't really give it a place. You know, we want kids who sit quietly in classrooms and don't ask those hard questions. It gets better in high school, gets better at universities. But I think there's a lot of small children who might be amazing scientists who are told to, you know, not ask so many questions. It's true.
Francesca, I want to read you a quote here and get you to comment. The quote is from Arpad Pushtay. And he writes this: when most of the funds that used to come from the government now come from industry, and when awards of the remaining state financial sponsorship of research become dependent on whether the project is supported by industrial money or not, from there on, science no longer simply just depends on industry, but its subservient relationship is close to, here comes the word, prostitution. And then the quote ends with this: the effect of all of this has been disastrous for science. Give us an example, if you would.
Oh, there's so many. You know, let's just look at an example that I think is so not controversial. Let's look at Herb Needleman, who was a doctor who was well known for his tireless commitment to researching the negative effects of lead exposure on children. You know, his prominence in the field put him in conflict with the lead industry all the time. The Lead Industries Association, the International Lead Zinc Research Association, you know, abused him, published letters over and over, calling his research flawed and irrelevant, labeling him as over-emotional and untrustworthy and an anti-lead fanatic. Now, this happened a while ago. We now know. We totally accept the fact that lead is a very dangerous chemical. But what we see are these public relations firms that are hired by industry, you know, and by trade associations, circulate this information, and it's a big problem.
Well, back to our electromotive situation here in London, one of the frustrations we've had in the media, it's hard to put a face on this Caterpillar company. What they do is they hire a public relations firm to simply send media releases. There's never a voice. There's never a human being. Give me an example of a whistleblower who is out there blowing the whistle with abandon. I'm thinking of ones who've had movies made about them, like Aaron Brockovich.
Right. I mean, I think there are many, many examples that don't get the attention, you know, that she did, and sort of get a big movie made about them. We know of many in the pharmaceutical industry. Many working at the Food and Drug Administration, where they've pointed out that, in fact, research studies were flawed. I'm thinking about, you know, Ketech. I'm thinking about Vioxx. I'm thinking about a number of these drugs that we've heard of where, in fact, you know, it was the drug reviewers at the Food and Drug Administration, which is our government agency that looks at this, that uncovered that the drug company, in this case Sanofi Adventis, was aware of the fraud in studies, in clinical studies, that it presented to the FDA.
Shouldn't people be going to prison for this sort of stuff?
Yes. In cases where, after due process, they're found to be guilty. And, in fact, in the Ketech case, a number of people did end up going to prison. But there were many, many doctors, drug reviewers, you know, very smart people at the Food and Drug Administration who left that agency over this particular drug, Ketech.
Francesca, we are having an animated discussion here in London we have had for months on the issue of fluoride in our water. It's coming to a head. We have a big public meeting set for a couple of weeks from now. What's the truth about fluoride?
I think the truth about fluoride is that, you know, a little bit is good and a lot is a problem. And I think that's what, you know, it's a very individual thing. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's all bad or it's all good. But I do think, you know, in the U.S., virtually all of our water contains some fluoride. You know, when you make a public health decision, you're weighing that against, you know, the lowering of cavities and all the rest. The problem comes that now there are so many other products that have fluoride that we end up getting too much. We end up with these massive dosages because it's a pylon.
Now, we have we had a Health Canada review published last year, and the six individuals who were involved in this review on fluoride were known to be pro-fluoride before the review was published. They didn't have any critical voices in the mix whatsoever. And what kind of science is that when you have so much bias on the one end?
I think bias isn't the problem. The problem is that if you do have one side of an issue presented, you need to make sure that you balance it so that you do and have, in fact, have a dialogue that really does get at the issue, that really does take on these issues. The problem is that very often, and in the U.S. as well, we're guilty of this as well, our scientific advisory committees, which are the committees of scientists that advise agencies and approve drugs and do all these other things, don't necessarily address that bias as well as they could. Conflict of interest is huge. The amount of money that flows to certain scientists that definitely influences the way they think about these issues and is not disclosed and is not, you know, does not result in them being eliminated from these advisory committees is huge and scary.
We have played a number of clips from the movie Liar, Liar. How many liar, liars do we have in North America, Francesca, who are lying to us about the products that we buy?
I don't have a number, but I think it's certainly too many. You know, obviously, we would want to have a situation where ghostwriting, for example, of biased scientific articles is exposed. The publication bias, where you only publish good results, is exposed. Where phony experts are not promoted. You know, all of these things are issues. All of these things need to be exposed and stopped.
Do we need a revolution at one level, whether it's at the top or it's at a grassroots level or within the scientific community? What's going to solve this problem?
Well, I think it's at all different levels. I mean, I think a lot of it is disclosure. I think transparency, you know, you've heard it many times, is the best disinfectant. Having this stuff out in the open, having very, very discriminating, careful consumers. Very important. People need to ask questions. We can't pound that out of them.
But Francesca, we're so busy. We have a short break, and when we come back, I just want to ask you, in conclusion, where this is all going. I mean, we so much applaud what you're doing with your Union of Concerned Scientists. Delighted that Canada is part of this. Delighted that Canada has invited you north. But I want to ask you to leave us with a challenge in terms of what we can all do to best promote what it is you're doing. When we come back in just a moment here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. We're in conversation with Francesca Griffo, who is with an organization called the Union of Concerned Scientists, suggesting there are more and more scientists who are fed up with having a gun to their head when it comes to telling the truth. Whistleblowers, we need more of them. Francesca, I wonder if in the short amount of time that we have left, we can do a couple of things. One is you've been painting the problem and sketching out the problem. One solution is legislation, and you now have a Physician Sunshine Act. I want you to tell us about that in the American context, and then we'll ask you about what's happening in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, I think what that does is consistent with what we've been talking about, which is disclosure. Our health care bill that passed last year, this part of it will come into effect next year, will require that pharmaceutical companies actually make publicly available all of the payments that they give to physicians and nurses and a lot of different healthcare officials.
Will we be shocked when we get that information?
Yes, I think you will be. We've seen a number of companies are already doing it ahead of the requirement. And in fact, it's pretty scary what you see there.
What would we have if that applies here in London, Ontario? What kinds of things are happening that we would be shocked by?
Well, I think you'd be shocked to know that your physician who's prescribing you is getting, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 from a pharmaceutical company in speaking fees. And to pretend that that isn't going to affect the way that they prescribe is just silly. I mean, we have many studies and human nature, you know, even if it's totally subconscious, and I don't mean to imply that doctors are bad people or certainly unethical in any way. I think it's just very hard to not have a payment like that influence the way that you think, even if you're not aware of it. And I think, you know, going to what we need to do about it, I think an enormous amount of this is holding folks accountable. I think we forget how powerful we are as citizens, and this is as true, you know, in Canada as it is in the United States. We need to hold our physicians accountable. We need to hold the officials that we elect accountable. We need to hold the companies that we invest in as stockholders accountable. You know, we need to use the media. I mean, there are many opportunities for letters to the editor and other kinds of writing.
But what happens when the media, what happens in the media when you're writing to people who don't know anything about science? There are no science reporters out there.
It's very true. They've been dramatically reduced with the reorganization of the media. But that makes it even more important for folks who do understand these issues to be sharing that information on the editorial pages.
Now, when it comes to the journals and publishing a lot of these studies thus far, people don't understand this massive conflict of interest that's going on. And when they're reading the research, they believe it's valid research, but they don't see that it's just ridden with conflicts.
Well, that's one of the places where I think we are seeing it turn around. Most of the reputable journals in this country are now requiring disclosure of funding as a part of the publishing of research. Ghostwriting still happens. That's essentially when companies put somebody's name on a paper and go ahead and publish it, perhaps without that author even seeing it, in return, you know, in exchange for money sometimes. It's still a problem. But the fact that we have to disclose where our research funds come from is very important.
Okay, Francesca, we have just 1 minute left. I wonder if I can give you the challenge here to do two things, 30 seconds each. One is just to summarize the problem. Secondly, summarize the solution.
The problem, in 30 seconds or less, is that we have an enormous amount of money influencing the system, inappropriate private sector influence in our science system all across the board, from universities to the federal government to the private sector. The solution is to be, you know, very, to hold them accountable. As consumers, we have power. We need to use that power. We need to have these conversations with our elected officials, have these conversations with our physicians.
Have you ever been pressured or, heaven forbid, threatened and told to just shut up and go away?
Luckily, no. I'm very lucky that I haven't. But we don't take government money. We don't take private sector money. We just take, you know, foundation and private donations.
There's a popular expression, Andy, that goes, progress can only happen one retirement at a time. And I think for science to progress, I think we need to see some very young new voices out there that are progressive and can avoid a lot of these types of conflicts.
Francesca, the hour has flown by. We thank you so much for joining us this morning, all the way from Washington. Happy New Year, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Happy
you.
New Year to you all.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Pam, anything else you want to cover before we sign off here?
No, I just have I have my nutrition classes coming up in February and every Saturday for the month. And so I hope to see some people out there.
Remind us of the meeting at City Hall.
And the fluoride meeting, the public participation meeting, is taking place on Wednesday, January 25th at 7 p.m. at Centennial Hall.
11 o'clock news just around the corner when we come back.